back to the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. I'm your host, Wade Wojcik, joined by David Ishida.
Hello.
Ben Robertson.
Second billing.
Ben Robertson.
Hi.
Late, the great. This is episode...
Soon to be a cat face.
This is episode...
Robertson.
What? Let the man talk.
This is episode 18. We're coming at you from Minneapolis, Minnesota, where the Super Bowl just happened.
Yeah, it's no longer. Thank you, God. Everybody's gone.
Yeah. For those not in the industry, the Super Bowl is a very busy time for
freelancers.
Freelancers especially. A lot of random jobs come up in and around the Super Bowl. But there's
and
a
Eagle fans that need to leave.
Yeah, who ride in the streets. So we've got a lot of awesome stuff to talk about this month. The Alexa large format camera, but David just shot me a shark. We're not just talking about the Alexa. We're talking about all large format cameras.
Well, most of them.
Yes.
Maybe not all of
sure,
them.
Sure, sure. And then for section two, tricks of the trade, effective trailers, how to craft one, what's an example or two of a good trailer, and what is not a good trailer, a.k.a.
most of them.
Most of them. And then this month we saw The Shape of Water, the latest Del Toro movie. And yeah, we're excited to talk about that too. So let's dive right in. Large format cameras, David, I don't know much about what makes a large format camera. Specifically, the Alexa that just dropped. So, you know, crash course
yeah.
us here.
Yeah.
So,
just define it, I guess. So we're just talking like a larger resolution or what?
It would be a larger sensor. Okay. When you're talking about this. And with these, I don't know if there's a proper like cutoff point about what starts to qualify as large format. But at this point, we'd probably be looking at anything that's like the size of full frame, full frame stills. So, you know, that's what people loved about the 5D cameras when they started doing video, because they offered a very, very shallow depth of field because of how large the sensor is. And those are all full frame because they're based on the digital sensor, which is, you know, it's supposed to model 35 millimeter film camera film. Mm-hmm. And so what we have as of probably this being, I think about 2 or 3 months ago, was announced the Sony Venice, which was the first cinema camera to be a full-frame sensor. So completely full-frame. So the size of the 5D sensor in a cinema camera.
Now, just real quick question. Is that like the optimal size of a sensor?
Well, it depends on who you ask.
Sure. Is it too big is what I'm asking?
It might be too big. It'll be interesting because one thing, like in the times, like we had we had 5D that we used for some of the behind-the-scenes photos, just the photos for... Dawn Under Heaven. Mm-hmm. And with that, at times, you know, we usually hand it off to someone just like, you know, snap behind the scenes photos, and, you know, things tend to be very rapid pace. We're jumping around having to get through a lot. And a lot of them were out of focus yeah. slightly because you're snapping them so quick and the depth of field is so shallow because of how large that sensor is. Mm-hmm. And
it was dark, and I think the...
Yeah, oh yeah, there were a lot of other issues. Yeah. And even when I've used the 5D to shoot video, you can deal with a very, very, very narrow depth of field because of the size of the sensor. Because when you're looking at depth of field, part of the calculation you look at is the sensor size, mm-hmm. is what affects depth of field along with the aperture yeah. of the lens.
But like, are cameras, you know, trying to get to that full frame size, or...
I think they are now.
Okay.
We can be sure that they are moving that way. Something that I was told... about 2 years ago at this point there was an interview being done with one of the manufacturers or one of the designers at Zeiss lenses, and the person said they think that in the next 5 to 10 years we are going to see something like full frame or like a 65 millimeter become the new standard, become the new Super 35.
Wow.
And what we now all know is Super 35 will become Super 16, so it'll be sort of a niche market,
sure,
used for specific situations. And so we had the Venice, the Sony Venice camera, mm-hmm. come out. It's going to be a 6K camera. It has, you know, 15 stops of dynamic range, which is up there with the Reds. The high-end Reds are up at that level. It basically, you know, if you look at it at a glance, it looks a lot like an Alexa.
How
really
much
does
this one cost?
This is, I believe, it's in the ballpark of about $45,000 to $50,000.
Okay.
For this one.
So it's meant to compete with that,
yes.
that market.
Yes.
Okay.
And when we had this come out, other than this camera, the only other large format, I would say readily available large format cameras that are out there were some of the Reds. Because like on the newer Reds, like on the, because at this time, it wasn't out yet, but it had been announced, was the Monstro sensor. Sorry, not Monstro, VistaVision. The VistaVision sensor from Red, which is as wide as full frame. Not as tall as full frame, but as wide as full frame. And And so then what we were seeing is people were liking this, and we saw also this resurgence of people using large format film as well. We had Dunkirk that was shot on 70 millimeter. Before that, we had things like Interstellar that was shot on 70 millimeter.
Hateful Eight,
exactly. So we had this people that are wanting this big sensor, this shallow depth of field. It just adds to this bigness to the screen, mm-hmm. if you will. And now really to add further credibility to that point. And real quick, I should say there was another digital camera. I'm sorry, I forgot about this one. The Alexa 65, which was a 65 millimeter digital camera. It is a rental only camera. I'm sure you cannot buy this camera.
Was it discontinued quickly or?
Nope, you can still get it.
Oh.
Because it's still bigger than any of these sensors because it's a double each direction, mm-hmm. because it's 65 millimeters. And that one is it's an expensive piece. Like you're gonna spend a lot of money
right.
Renting that. A lot of The Revenant was shot on the Alexa 65. But now to further add credence to this trend is Arri. Arri has now come out with a new camera. Unfortunately, not a new line of cameras. I was hoping they would make a third line because they have the Alexa and the Amira right now. And they have the Alexa LF, large format. And all they did, which it's simple and effective, so I can't fault them for it. It's a great idea. They have their sensors, the LEV 3 sensors, the one that has been in almost all of their cameras of late. It's a stunning sensor, arguably one of the best looking sensors in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody loves it. And all they did was take two of them, turn them sideways, and stick them together.
Literally or just principle?
In principle, that's what they did. They didn't, okay. There's not a seam running down the middle or anything.
Right.
But that's all they did. They just took two of the sensors that everyone loves, stuck them together, and now you have something that's a little bit bigger than
same full frame. Everything else, just
same everything else. Sensor. Yep. Okay. So it's going to have the same color science that we're used to, the beautiful way it handles highlights and roll offs and skin tones and that kind of stuff.
Now this is also the first Alexa that can do 4K. Is that correct?
It's the first one, other than the 65. Because the 65 can do 6K. But it's the first of the more readily accessible ones that you could conceivably buy. Meaning that it costs less than $200,000. Mm-hmm. and it's one that a lot of rental houses will probably get that is native 4K. So if you got an Alexa Mini or an Amira right now and you wanted to shoot in 4K, you can switch to UHD. But what it's doing is it's taking the 3.2K native resolution of the sensor and up-resing it into 4K,
mm-hmm.
which looks great. I can't fault it. It looks fine.
But one thing that we noticed is that Netflix specifically wants for their original content to be 4K un-up-res.
Correct. So that means, so far, the main camera of any Netflix original could not be an Arri camera, which annoyed a lot of people because there's a whole lot of people that love Arri cameras and want to shoot them all the time. And now they can with this camera. This camera is natively, I think it's 4.5K is what its native full open gate resolution is.
And so how does this price compare to a typical, like an entry-level Alexa?
It would... Actually, not terribly far from the entry. If you've got the low-end Alexa right now, you're probably in some ballpark. You're in about $95,000, $100,000, mm-hmm. To purchase this camera, meaning its rental rate will probably be in the ballpark of about $1,500 to $2,000-ish. And the other thing they did with this camera, though, is they have a new lens mount, and that is a big deal because, new lens mounts do not come around very often. You don't see Red making a new lens mount. It's a big deal. And so Arri made the LPL mount. So Arri's mount that's been for a very long time is the PL mount. It's a staple of the industry. It's a very strong, very well-designed mount. And now they just have the LPL, the large PL mount. So it's a little bit bigger.
What is PL? Permanent lock?
Positive lock.
Positive lock.
Yeah, positive lock.
Gotcha.
It's immensely robust. It's a great lens mount. And so they do have an adapter, so you can get an adapter and put on normal PL mount lenses mm-hmm. as well. And there's a special sensor crop mode because normal 35 millimeter glass will not cover the sensor that's that large. Some may be able to, but it's going to be a little close at times.
So does that mean you have to use different lenses for this large format
yes,
camera?
If you want to use the full size of the sensor, they have a new line of lenses coming out. I think it's called the Arri Signature Series. Interestingly enough, they're not made by Zeiss, which is interesting because most of the Arri lenses are made by Zeiss. They usually say Arri on them, and then they'll have Zeiss next to it. And there's rumor that the glass at least, it's possible that the housing is being made somewhere in Germany, or Arri is based in Germany, but the glass is from Japan. And so there are some beliefs that the glass inside is likely Tokina glass. We've talked about it before, I believe at the NAB episode of the podcast, about the new Tokina full frame glass that they'd come out with those getting rave reviews.
And is that a good thing or a bad thing, I guess?
Does it excite you or terrify you?
It's going to be interesting. You know, the Glass is very, very well reviewed. People really like it. It's really good. And, you know, it is the Germans. They will not compromise on quality. So
Man of many accents.
Yeah, so if they think it's good enough, then if Harry says it's good enough, that's good enough for me.
Okay.
And as I said, what we see in this change now that's going to be happening, because we have some people that, like, sort of in our age group of it, that have shot on, like, 5Ds and DSLRs and large format sensors, and so we're now going to see that start to continue to creep up into the high-end cinema market. And what that will mean in the long term is, you know, in 10, 15 years, there probably won't be a huge demand for super 35mm glass anymore, because it's all going to need to be capable of covering larger formats. And, you know, for a while, cameras will do what the Arri can, where it will have a cropped mode, where it will just crop down to give you a super 35 frame, so you can still use that glass. But we're going to start to see that trend.
So does that mean that, for all intents and purposes, the lenses that we use and see every day essentially have a shelf life. They have a lifespan that's going to run out.
Yep. Just like Super 16, you can still get Super 16 glass at a lot of rental houses. And some cameras do have a Super 16 mode. The Arri Amira has a Super 16 mode where it will crop down, so you can use Super 16 glass.
You heard it here first, folks. Sell those lenses. Sell. We'll buy them. So so that's about, you said the Alexa LF is about 95K, but then the Sony one, that was, you said 45?
Yep.
Is that kind of the range we can expect for this type of camera that's LF?
For right now, yes. It's going to be in there. The other one that, again, would be in that side would be some of the Red VistaVision or the Red Monstro sensors are also larger format.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, those are, I think, you know, in the ballpark, they're about $50,000 for those.
Okay. And are those full frame or equivalent?
They're as wide as full frame.
Gotcha.
The Monstro is a little bit bigger. Not and it, I don't know if it's as tall yet.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, we are going to see this change happening. I'd probably give it maybe 3 more years, and then we're going to start to see that seep lower. I could probably see the first camera maker to make that jump into the lower end cinema market, the market of, say, between about $10,000 and $25,000, will probably be Canon, because they've had their DS, like their 5D and their 1DX, that have been full frame video capable. There's some other shortcomings to the sensor, shortcomings to the processors, which is, I think, why we haven't seen that already shift into, like, the cinema EOS line, like the C100, C300 era. But I think they're probably going to be one of the first.
Okay. If they're more smart. Poised to kind of get
right,
into that.
Right, because, like, it's tried and true. It's like, you know, hey, guys, you've been shooting on the 5D Mark IV or the 5D Mark III forever. Now we just put that same thing in a C300 body,
and
you're done. So it will be a mistake if they don't.
Is it strange that they haven't done that already, then?
Yes. Or
is it, okay.
But I think if they are reading the signs, which, as we are seeing, we're seeing that happening in high-end cinema. And, you know, usually what we see in high-end cinema will filter down, given time, like with almost anything. And if they don't do it, it will be a huge mistake. If they're not developing something of that that is for the C300-ish area, it's a huge mistake.
Hmm.
And they will regret it if they don't have something going on there.
So the new line of lenses that are going to start to come out to adapt to this new large format style camera, how much more are they than typical?
Well, it depends, because right now there are many of the new cinema lenses that came out at NAB last year are already full frame capable, because the lens makers were seeing this trend, especially with the Red VistaVision sensor, because it's as wide as full frame. So you need a full frame lens to be able to cover that width. So, you know, if you look at, like, the Canon L series lenses, ones that are designed for full frame photos, those already would cover anything of that width. And so you can't put EF mount on the Alexa LF that is only PL or LPL. They don't make that adaptable like the Amira or the Alexa Mini.
What if I just gaff tape it?
That'll work. Absolutely. There you go. No, why did I even say it?
Homemade adapter.
But many of the new lenses are already designing to cover that one. You look at the people who've been doing it for a long time, which is Leica. Leica lenses, the Thalia line and the Summicron line, those ones are already designed to cover full frame, so those will all work. And those are very expensive. Like, you're talking like $150,000 for a set of 5 lenses for those.
Wow.
But if you look at the Canon Cinema EOS line, which again is from Canon, can't go PL mount, but those all cover full frame. If you look at the Zeiss CP2 or CP3 line, already designed for full frame, we'll cover it. And the newer ones, the ones I think I mentioned on the last podcast, the year in review episode, I talked about the Sigma full frame primes. Those will all cover it already. And as well as the Tokina lenses will all cover full frame already.
Wow. So it's do you think they anticipated that shift? Okay. Yes.
And I think the big thing was Red doing that, because as soon as Red started like, hey, we're making wider sensors, they're like, Red has been really doing a lot of pushing this industry forward in technology and capabilities. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the Red One and what it did to revolutionize the digital aspect of the industry, and so it's like, oh, they're starting to do that. Other camera makers will follow. We should start making our lenses that will cover all that.
It makes me really wonder, without Red, like what Arri would be doing today, if not for Red.
They may be a little further behind, but not far off, because they did have a digital camera in that era-ish, being the D20 or D21? Can't remember. D20 or D21 camera. Hmm. Completely bombed. It was a terrible camera. Okay. It was really bad. No one liked it.
Well, so it seems like, more and more cameras are going to be a full frame, large format sensors, and maybe they won't stop there. Maybe it'll just get bigger and bigger.
Yep, eventually we will be using dinner plates.
or be eclipsed by 360 or something like that. Yeah. Who knows?
I don't know about 360.
Well, I think it kind of depends upon your audience, like who wants to see what.
Yeah, that's a discussion for another time. That'll be an interesting one.
Tune in next time for that. Great. So
not necessarily next episode. Yeah. Just later. Yeah. Keep listening. You have to make sure now you listen to every single episode. Find out what we're going to talk about that.
Because we're not going to post it in the episode notes. You won't know. all right. We're going to be right back and talk about effective trailers. So you may be sitting in a movie theater, got your popcorn, got your pop.
It'd be kind of weird if you were listening to this podcast while watching trailers.
Yeah, but
I applaud you.
I applaud you.
David, I applaud you.
David applauds you.
I applaud you.
This intro's been ruined. So you find yourself in the theater ready to watch the next Marvel movie or whatever, and all of a sudden a trailer comes on for the next Star Wars and you don't want to see it. You have your friend next to you.
Bolt out of the theater.
You cover your ears and eyes and they start yelling at you to cover up the sound. Why? Because the trailer spoils all the major plot points.
Sounds like you're speaking from experience, Wade.
Well, not my experience, but yours, Ben.
Yeah, this is very
true. This has happened to you. I think we were, what movie was it that came on?
Who knows?
I think we were at the zoo or some theater then. And
yeah, you ran out.
I did run out.
You left.
Yep, I did. Because this was like for The Force Awakens. This
It was early.
Before we dive in, why do you avoid Star Wars trailers?
It sets expectations and will ruin a plot. I mean, like you play so many trailers nowadays, I feel like just give you enough where any person who understands like how movies are made these days ruins, I don't know.
Yeah.
Gives away too much.
It's very interesting to notice how trailers through the ages have followed a formula. I mean, everyone knows the cliche of the voiceover guy, like, in a world filled with blank, blankety blank.
You watch Tropic Thunder, you have all five of those.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And those cliches have now become very dated and fallen out of style and now have made way for new formats and you know, ways that trailers are structured. And we have a couple examples of trailers that follow this format to their detriment, and then examples that break the format that I think are much better and more effective trailers that entice but don't give away plot points. The examples of the good ones we watched before the episode, I would argue one would be like Django Unchained, and then we didn't watch it, but I know that the Interstellar trailer is fantastic at showing you the premise, roughly what's happening, mm-hmm. without giving away huge plot points and A-list actors that are in the film that no one knew about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like Matt Damon.
Spoiler.
Oh, yeah, spoiler.
There it goes.
Oh, sorry. How old is that movie?
Old enough.
Yeah, almost 4 years old. Anyway, so you have other movies. We wrote down like Jurassic World and Passengers, both starring Chris Pratt. That basically...
Take the hint, Mr. Pratt.
They show you...
One of my friends saw him at a bar here for the Super Bowl. I should have told her to tell him, to tell the editors, to not give away everything in his movie.
And I don't know if that's because, you know, maybe the film is outsourced to a third party, you know, trailer production company.
They are a lot of times.
Yeah.
There are companies that do nothing but edit the trailers.
Right.
And they, you know, we're talking like a couple million per trailer.
Yeah.
They get paid just to cut that.
But take like Jurassic World. So, you know, you have the premise, you have the end of the first act basically shown in the trailer. Then you have like all the shit going down and like everyone running and screaming. It's like, we didn't watch Jurassic Park's trailer before this, but I don't get the sense that in Jurassic Park you got all that in the trailer.
No, you don't.
Maybe you just got like the sense, like the setup of the park, and maybe something is going to go wrong. Right. But we don't know what and like who's going to die. And
or who's responsible.
Oh, the other one, Passengers, I saw that trailer and then just didn't want to even watch the movie because of so much was given away. So I feel your pain, Ben. But I still watch all the Star Wars trailers.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've teetered on whether or not to watch Han Solo because I already kind of know it's going to be bad. So yeah. Why do I, like, maybe I should just go in for
it. But I wish I didn't watch the Last Jedi trailers because I think the thing with Kylo Ren saying like, join me and like extending his hand, like, oh, I'm like, that's really cool. I wish I hadn't seen that.
Yeah.
So there are moments that I feel like are spoiled in these new trailers.
Yeah, and I wonder as to why that's being done. Because like why would you give a trailer that gives away the whole plot when you have a franchise that more or less is just going to be able to sell on its own?
Well, here's something that I think is interesting. There's a joke made in a very early season of Futurama. When these aliens, bear with me, when these aliens come to the planet because they want to see the end of this TV series that, you know, took, you know, 1,000 years to get to their planet. They've been watching it and they want to see the final episode. And so that it is deemed that the Planet Express people all need to go and put on the ending of this episode that got cut off.
That's right. And otherwise they'll destroy the planet.
Right, exactly. And so in it, there's a moment when they sort of lose the script part of it and they need to ad lib. And Leela does something completely strange and unexpected. And then they cuts the commercial and Fry runs him and says, Leela, what are you doing? He's like, what? I was doing something different and unexpected. It's great. And he's like, no. Television audiences don't want to be surprised. They want to be comforted. They don't want these strange things. And my point being is, I wonder if there's a part of the modern audience that doesn't want to be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to be taken in a direction they weren't expecting. You know, we live in this world now that is filled with spoilers. You go, anything new comes out and you can rest assured if you're on Facebook or social media, you are seeing spoilers for that thing the next day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that, a recent one, this is a very nerdy thing, not want spoilers about, but Ben was with me on Tuesday. We were working and it was the SpaceX launch of the Falcon Heavy. Yeah. And I avoided all the social media because I didn't want to know because I couldn't watch it live. I didn't want to know
spoilers for real life events.
Yes, I didn't want to know what happened. I wanted to be able to watch the launch unbiased from it. But I think we're at this point where like people, I feel like they're looking at audience and they're thinking that audiences want to get about 80% of the way there on their own before the movie,
or maybe
20%,
or maybe they think that's a better marketing campaign. Like they can sell it better if people know more about it. I don't know.
No, I think that's a good.
But also
point too.
one interesting element that we're not taking into account is so much of marketing for anything basically can be helped by viral videos, by reaction videos. So like going on YouTube and Googling or searching Last Jedi trailer reactions. I mean, there's so.
That's
it's
true.
Just like endless videos of people reacting to trailers. And so if you have a film like Last Jedi, you know, they had the first trailer, the second trailer, the third trailer.
Yep.
And each time they just get this like slew of reaction videos that gets sent out to everybody watching YouTube, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything on trending will be like the trailer, the reactions of the trailer. It's genius from a marketing perspective. And I think that, you know, you can't make, you know, the same trailer again and again and again. You're going to have to show a little bits more. So for like Force Awakens, they didn't show Han and Chewie until the second trailer. And it was the first trailer was where the big reveal was the Millennium Falcon.
Right.
Second one was Han and Chewie. And the third one was, I can't even remember, but it's just like each new trailer is something big for people to talk about. It's like this little hype pulse that goes out into the interwebs.
Well, and I think that's the word that that it is, right? It's hype. Like it's all about creating, creating hype to like around this event because going to see a movie is now an event versus something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know.
And I think when you're looking at crafting a trailer, because maybe you, Wade, you can speak to that because so we had for Dawn, there was the prelude, what we call now the prelude, which was originally teaser 2, which we shot years ago, which then became what we called the prelude.
Yeah, because it's like a short that
isn't in
the movie, but ties into the movie.
Yeah, and also to be fair, it's structured in such a way that if you didn't see that prelude, you're not at a loss.
Right.
You like the story still makes sense, which is an important thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But then more recently we had our sort of first official teaser for it came out. And I've heard very good, like I show that to a lot of people when I'm talking about stuff we've worked on, and a lot of people really like it. Because you know, it it you get these teases of what's going to be there with interesting images. And I feel like the things that make our film unique, we highlight what make our film look good.
Yeah.
And but in a way that's not giving away. Like one, there's a shot in the trailer that I'm not going to say, I'm going to say what the shot is, but not where it is in the story. But there's a shot that doesn't give away any plot, but it's this, you know, we see this gorge and these people walking in it.
Yeah.
And we get these really cool moments that I feel like it was well done, that it would catch people's interest, but it's not going, it's going to make them say, wait, what?
Yeah.
Wait, I need to know more. And, I want to know more.
And two important points for that. One, it being a short teaser trailer, I made it a point to not set up the premise, but still like show interesting bits to get people, like you said, enticed and wanting to know more. So the two changes I would make for an official trailer is to maybe make it twice as long. I don't know about maybe a minute. I wouldn't go further just because it's only a 30-minute film. There's only so much you can show in a trailer.
Yeah.
And to set up the premise.
You get to 2 minutes and you're getting to a noticeable percentage
exactly,
of the film.
Exactly. So what I would do for an actual trailer is to set up the premise and make it about a minute, but not show key plot points after the you know premise, and to definitely not show big reveal moments, because like to me as a storyteller, like showing that and just blowing that wide open is like I would not risk people being more interested to you know reveal stuff that I think is better left for viewing the film.
So it seems like there's almost three types of like pre-launch marketing. There's like the teaser, there's the trailer, and we're starting to see now this more emerging thing of like what we did with like Dawn, the prelude, but like you also look at like Blade Runner had like all the previous little short movies that kind of came along that were part of the universe but not necessarily part of integral to the main plot of the story. But are all serving the function of getting people excited and into the world or the movie or whatever. And I think something, at least for me, that I've tried to learn is like, what do I want to watch to best help my experience of watching the movie? And so like for me now, like Star Wars, I don't watch anything because I already know I'm going to see it, and I don't need any insight into what it's going to be. But I'll watch like a teaser to like a Marvel movie because like I'm interested to see what's going on, but I don't want to be spoiled for a plot, even though I probably.
So I wonder if we need to start a trend. Us, we need to, when we put out the trailer for Dawn, we should label it official trailer, parentheses no spoilers. We should call ourselves out already that there are not going to be major plot spoilers.
So basically saying if that was a trend. A trailer would either be labeled no spoilers or spoilers.
Yes. It's not going to happen, but we can start something.
Yeah.
Or just like, it's like a little PSA to whoever's watching, like don't watch this unless you don't want to be. Yeah.
So Ben, I guarantee, so you mentioned wanting to watch teasers and trailers for like a Marvel thing. I guarantee the next one we watch will start with blah.
Yeah. it was so strange. So like the Han Solo teaser or whatever, like David showed me the first like, he was like,
I tried
Ben,
to force you.
Ben, watch this or whatever. Like the first like 5 seconds of it, I hear that bwah sound. I'm like, where is this coming from? How's that sound ever entered into like a Star Wars universe?
I love how we all know the key it's in too. It's bwah.
Yeah. It all started with Inception, right? That was the Inception sound.
That's the first time I recognized that. I mean, maybe like an iteration of that was earlier, but I think that's the one that everyone picked up on, and that's how it just got really, you know, got rolling.
Yep. And actually, and that's maybe another thing about when you're crafting a teaser is very carefully choose your music for if it's going to be, you know, I feel like it doesn't happen quite as often now because now there's this thing, there's like people that specialize in trailer music, like what is it, Two Steps from Hell?
Yeah,
they only do trailer music. Or there's another thing there's a very interesting video by, I think it's on Every Frame of Painting, about temp music and the use of temp music. But for a long time, you could see trailers would reuse other music from popular movies.
Yep.
The three big ones that I know got used all the time was Pirates of the Caribbean. That was used everywhere. The music from, which I can't hum now that I'm thinking about it, but from Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, the Kevin Costner film, that music was used everywhere in trailers after that movie came out. And then the third one is, excuse me, it is a sort of modern like Inception, like they use Inception music a lot.
I have one. You guys seen The Island, Michael Bay? So no. There's
oh my gosh, I haven't a long, long. I don't even remember anything about that
there's
movie.
There's a song at the end when he finally like they escape and they're happy.
Spoilers.
It's called the song's called My Name Is. You're not gonna see that. It's called My Name Is Lincoln, and that same exact track is used in a trailer for Avatar.
Interesting.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. And so what? Yeah. So you really should carefully choose your music because of what then expectations are going to be. Based on like if it's already it's like oh that sounds like Inception, is that going to start to influence your audience's perception of your work? If they're like oh that's Inception, oh that reminds me of Pirates of the Caribbean. Again, not even if you use the same exact music, you know, I don't think our audience would be in a place where they're going to be licensing music from Pirates of the Caribbean or Hans Zimmer.
Right. Sure,
but or if you use similar sounding music,
I mean, you can go
very
to
mindful.
You
of
can
that.
Go to Pond 5, which is a royalty free music site.
Pond5.com.
Yeah, and just type in like Tron, and it'll give you like five different options that sound like Tron,
right,
but are like slightly different, like off brand versions.
That's all about like setting expectations for your audience, right? I mean, like when you look at the Christopher Nolan movies, like as you mentioned, Interstellar, none of what's in there sets you up for the other kind of like sci-fi stuff for that film.
They picked a great song for one of their trailers. It's from what album? I'll find it.
But it's like it's misleading your audience to I don't know, like I guess the like those Christopher Nolan movies I'm thinking of, they almost intentionally mislead their audience for them to be even hit harder by the twist or the other things that happen. Like for like wasn't Inception was never, the trailers never gave you the impression it was about dreams or anything like that. It was just someone stealing like an information or something like
no,
that.
No, I think there's some allusions to dreams.
There's some dream stuff in there, but it's like it's not like hammered home, you know. Yeah. I mean, Inception's another great example because you don't really get the sense.
Yeah, you don't like, understand the stakes. You don't understand the whole background of his wife, and you know the risks that are involved in it.
Yeah, it's basically you like watching the trailer. You think, oh, this is gonna be a visual treat. It's gonna be action. It's gonna like be mind bending. That's all you really know. You don't know like the emotional stakes. The album is Sun by Thomas Bergerson, and it's a great album.
I think he's a part of Two Steps from Hell, actually.
Yeah. Another trope before, as we wrap up this segment, that I want to die is how a trailer will like build up, crescendo, and have like a dramatic conclusion, and then titles, and then sound will fade away, and then it'll come in with like a comedic little sting at the end.
Or like give you the first like the 5-second clip of the whole trailer before it's set, like, you know, like they're being cut now for YouTube, so like when they play as an ad, they'll show seconds.
Like or Facebook autoplay, so it'll be like the first 5 seconds, and then like, watch the trailer, and then the trailer will start, which I get from a marketing perspective. You know, people with short attention spans want to just dive in.
You need to hook them with that rather than hook them with this trailer is prepared for all audiences.
Well, you see that with a lot of YouTube content too. It's no longer like 30-second intro then content. It's real quick like intro thing, cold open, then well actually that's not new though, because you'd see that with like the X-Files did it.
That kind of thing has been going. You know, you look at all the Simpsons all start with cold opens of maybe it's not really a cold open is probably the wrong title for what the Simpsons, because what the episode leads with then leads into the story of the episode itself.
Well, I think this is all just to try to hook you before you press the skip ad button.
Right.
Yep.
That's skip ad button.
I gotta say, very rarely works.
Yeah.
Very.
Yeah.
Usually it's like, oh, that's an interesting trailer. Skip, new tab. Look up that trailer. Like.
But anyway, so as far as crafting an effective trailer, first understand like what you want to say in it and who your audience is. But I would recommend not giving away key plot points for sake of clicks and that sort of thing. But that's my opinion. And it don't spoil your content.
You don't have to take my word for it.
Oh, get out of here, LeVar Burton.
Yeah.
Is that like a Reading Rainbow?
Reading Rainbow, oh. Yep.
All right, we're going to be right back and talk about The Shape of Water. So, guys, hey, what did you think of the trailer for The Shape of Water? Was it effective?
Well, let's dive right into it. And I think... God damn it, David. We made that joke in five seconds ago.
No one laughed, but here we go.
Well, like the trailer was, again, I think what, like a little misleading, right? It didn't... I don't feel like it really kind of led up to like the darker stuff of the movie. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I feel like the trailer was more light and airy versus the experience I actually had.
Sure. Yeah. I get that. I don't know. To me, it did a good job of setting up the premise, setting up, you know, this woman's attachment to this creature and like how it made her feel more more complete as a person. And so I thought it was like, all right, interesting.
I thought it was setting up to be more of a mystery than anything else.
What kind of mystery?
Of like who, like what this thing was or who is it or whatever. Like I figured it was going to be a little bit more of like a monster movie versus a relationship movie.
Sure. Okay.
So I just scrubbed through the trailer just now. I think this is the first trailer for it, which I realized I don't know if I ever saw this trailer. I may have seen like a really early teaser, but I don't think I saw this main trailer. It's all there.
What is?
You can figure it out, the whole plot.
Oh,
you do.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all, you get a real sense of the pacing and whatnot from the film. But you know, there's, you know, even when trailers give away things, like, you know, there's things that are pleasantly surprising or interesting that can still... Yeah.
But I will actually say for this specific movie, and maybe it's just Del Toro's style in general, but what it doesn't give away are some of the most valuable parts of the film, which are the character moments.
Yes, absolutely.
I think that's completely hidden from the trailer. So a lot of my favorite parts of the film are like, I'm forgetting the name of the guy who Eliza lived with, but his whole subplot,
yeah,
where he's, so it's like, you know, it takes place in the American 50s where people of color and
50s or 60s.
Yeah, I thought it was maybe 50s, but people of color are kind of shunned and ostracized in like the diner, but also one of the male leads who is homosexual ostracized.
Spoilers, by the way.
Oh,
for this.
Well, we do spoilers.
Yeah,
in
I know.
Every episode.
I just didn't want to call it.
No, he had a lot of great, interesting moments that added such texture to his character that I really appreciate.
And I don't mean to sidetrack us.
Giles.
Well, actually, is it ever said? Because he only really ever talks to Eliza, and she doesn't say his name.
I don't think so.
So.
And I don't know if I'm sidetracking us too much into our serious discussion before we normally do our. Like what, or real quick,
oh,
what we thought of it.
Do
we want to do that,
yeah,
or should
I
just dive in?
Dive in.
Okay. But one thing I really, really enjoyed from it is there are these layers of the characters. So we have all these main characters. You have Eliza, you have Zelda, you have Giles, you have the creature, and you have the spoiler, major spoiler, the Russian spy. Mm-hmm. All
Wait,
of them.
Say that in your accent.
The Russian spy worked with KGB for many years. You have all these characters, and these are the outcasts of society. All five of them are outcasts in society in their own way. You have Giles, who is gay. You have Zelda, who is African American and dealing with the racism and prejudices that were so very widely prevalent. Mm-hmm. Many points in the movie that is brought up. You have the Russian, who is. On the one part of ostracized being a Soviet spy, an enemy of the state, but also
a socialist communist,
mm-hmm. which was, you know, we're starting to get into the Red Scare era of things.
Red herring.
And then you, thank you. Mm-hmm. Then you have Elsa. Wait, Elsa?
Yeah.
Eliza,
thank you. Mm-hmm. And she is a mute and cannot speak.
Yeah.
So you have all these characters, and then you have the Mr. Strickland. Which I gotta say, when she said that, I just thought of Back to the Future.
Yeah,
I just went to Back
Isn't
to the Future.
Isn't that the principal?
Yes, the bald. Yeah. God, did that man ever have hair?
Strickland, what a good name for an antagonist.
Exactly. And then you have him, who, look at him, he is the American dream.
He
has,
oh, yeah.
He has the picturesque house.
Every time
two kids, boy and girl.
Yeah.
Loving
sitting
wife.
In front of the TV with their toys. Every time it cut to his house, I thought it was a photograph of
right.
like the
it's
ideal 50s
yep.
scenario.
Yep. And then you have the loving wife who is willing to do anything for him.
Mm-hmm.
Literally.
Even like allow his dead zombie fingers in her mouth.
Yeah. Or near her mouth anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, going for the Cadillac, the pinnacle of class that you could have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you have these two opposing groups
right.
going against each other. Yeah. I thought that was really, really well
yeah.
crafted and set up.
Speaking of, was Stickler?
Strickland.
So he reminded me a lot of the villain in Pan's Labyrinth, Del Toro film from 11 years ago, 12 years ago, it was 2006. A great film if you guys haven't seen it. Anyway, so that takes place in the Spanish Civil War in the 40s, and... the main character, this girl, named Ophelia has a new stepfather who's Captain Vidal, who's like head of an army. Anyway, he basically is the same kind of guy, same archetype of character, like very strict paternal, figure who is very, like very strict, you know, punishes the people under him and eventually tries to, kill I think Pan. Anyway, the the tone and kind of themes of Pan's Labyrinth I felt very prevalent in this film as well. So you got like strange otherworldly creatures who are being hunted and essentially attempted to be killed, and by this kind of like strict paternal figure from like another era essentially. Mm-hmm. So I'm sensing that kind of theme in Del Toro's work, which I think is, you know, very effective. Pan's Labyrinth, $19 million budget as well. Which, yeah. I think this was $19 million.
Yeah, but 19.5. Yep.
He's able to make these films for very cheap.
Yeah. It would make every penny count.
We kind of skipped it, but yeah, what do you guys think of the movie?
I thought that it was delightfully odd, and at moments very charming, and I think very refreshing as well.
Sure.
I
mean, yeah, it's not common you see a film these days that has full three-dimensional characters that have mm-hmm. their odds and quirks and things like that,
which make them more real.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, we are filled with all these, what, I don't know, for lack of a better term, normal characters that are completely normal, and there is no normal person. Everyone has quirks about them, their own way of doing things that makes it believable and interesting.
With the exception of the five-star general, I wanted a little bit more. Maybe that was just he had to serve a function, and they didn't want to give him more depth.
Yeah, and I think because he I think was the antagonizing or pushing force behind Strickland, yeah, and I think they wanted to keep that as the ambivalent, not ambivalent, the military, you know, the big, you know, overseers
which
of everything.
Was approaching dangerous levels of South Park's Mr. Science Guy.
Yeah, that's true.
Like,
son, you count how many, you see how many stars on my yeah. uniform? Let's count.
It's a common trope that South Park pokes fun at, where it's like you've got the no nonsense military type who doesn't care about science or compassion. He just wants to kill and get the job done.
Well, mm-hmm. I think you make a good point, Wade, as far as talking about like function, like the, mm-hmm. the characters are more than just a means for the plot to move forward.
Yeah,
they are kind of they all have like little bits of stories for themselves, like with Gills and Zelda, but they all like they're all individuals, I think, versus just mm-hmm. like a way for the plot to move forward with Eliza and Ocean Man.
Yeah, what's his name? Does he have a name?
Yeah, I don't think they ever listen to name.
It was really enjoyable to watch Eliza kind of come out of her shell too as well. She starts mm-hmm. the film, I mean, she's still kind of fully formed. She's confident. She has an, you know, maybe a meeker form of confidence, but then as the film progresses and she connects with this this sea creature more and more, she kind of like casts off any meekness she had and just becomes this bold you know, the character who just goes after what they want. I especially enjoy the scene where he's being kept in her bathroom tub and she just decides to flood the entire room to be with him. It's completely submerged in water, mm-hmm. which is ludicrous. I would never do that, but I thought it was cool that she did. Yeah. And it's just like, is that going to flood the whole building? Yep. But she does it anyway. Yep.
And you like also a strange take on like a Disney princess movie a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
They introduce her as like a princess in like the opening
monologue.
They do,
yeah. They call her a princess.
And then like the dude that she falls in love with, like they've referred to multiple times as like a god or like a god figure. Mm-hmm. And then eventually she's like pushed off away into this, like she's taken away from the world that she was a part of, yeah. that she wanted to leave anyway, and then just go like live happily ever after. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I wanted to know a little bit more about the scars on her neck. They didn't really talk about them.
Yeah, they just said that's why she never talked.
Well, when
they
mentioned
cut her
like
voice
when,
box.
Yeah, when she was a kid, they cut her voice box. Yeah. Like that.
Well, she was like that. Yeah, that's how it was.
Man, and that then Strickland's, was that his name, Strickland? His weird fetish for like wanting silence during sex. Yeah. Oh.
I thought it was like a dominance thing is what it was.
I guess, yeah.
But also another interesting, as you're talking about this change of her character over it,
yeah.
another interesting one is you look at her clothing and then you look at after the day after she has brought the monster home, the creature home, and also conversely also after they've just had sex for the first time, and she wears a red coat after that. Before that, it was always a blue coat that matched, a blue or dark green coat that was matching the uniform, and then it changed to red and a red hairband after that moment.
Also, one of the biggest parts of this movie, which I think we need to talk about, is the suit that I think that guy was wearing.
Yes.
Right? I mean, that's practical. That was a suit.
Interestingly enough, I've been flipping through a VFX breakdown for the movie.
Oh, okay.
And it looks like it was a practical thing with a fair amount of CGI augmentation on top of it.
That's brilliant. Because when I first saw the trailer, I thought, oh, it's just a CG dude. But then to know that, I reached a point of critical mass in the movie where I'm like, okay, this is not all CG. This is a suit.
Yep. Yep. And I'm, like, one thing I'm sort of scrubbing through, I'm trying to figure out, because one thing I was very curious about is the blue lights that come to the character, if that was practical or not. I'm not finding anything immediately about that.
Yeah, so on his skin, he had like the kind of weird glowing patterns that was like, you know, glowing algae or just something that reminded me of like, you know, aquatic life that kind of glows on the shores. But it was very cool, very iridescent.
Yep. And yeah, so it looks like with a lot of it, it was augmenting onto a practical suit, so adding some more gills or detail on the gills.
Some of the gills looked like they were absolutely practical.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, and I think there were, like, you know, looking at some of them, and again, I'm just scrubbing through real fast, not watching this video with any real critical attention. And it looks like a lot of it is there, and it's just adding like one more filler or giving them a little more animated pop as they come
open. And they probably use CG, I think, for some of the eyelid blinking.
Yes, I think that.
But it's used to complement versus supplement.
Absolutely, which I think just sells it so well.
Mm-hmm.
I think they did a great job on that creature.
Well, and it's cool with a lot of the camera moves that were done that you can see that it's a fully built out set.
Yeah,
like the whole crew is pushed away, and it's just like the fully formed and I guess functional set. So like there's a couple of times I think earlier on in the movie when the camera ends up doing a full 360 motion where you don't see anybody at all.
What set is that on?
That I believe that's in the pool in the lab.
Okay.
Which is cool because like it gives you where so much of the movie is in this lab for the audience. It lets you know like where you are and where things are, and this is like I feel like it's a great establishing. It's a great establishment of where the film is going to take place, and so you're not spending your time as an audience member figuring out where people are. Mm. You can put your focus on what is happening with the characters.
Yeah. There's also they did a really good job of making me as an audience member feel an American, feel sympathetic towards a Russian spy.
Sure. I'm not sure if that's ever been done before. Yeah.
But that's, I mean, he's that's the thing. Like, I think in every other piece of fiction I've seen that has a Russian spy, they portray him as this kind of like heartless, evil character.
They're the evil Russians.
Mm-hmm. But in this sense, it was like, okay, he's a Russian spy, but also he's a compassionate scientist who cares about life. And I like that a lot. I think they did a great job with him. He was the lead in A Serious Man, 2008 film shot in Minneapolis.
Yes,
and in that film, he's portrayed as a very meek kind of, beta male or whatever, where he just like, he can't take control of his life and his wife's cheating on him and he's very sad and mopey the whole time. But in this film, he's just like this like stern, like take no shits kind of guy.
Yeah.
Really, really impressive performance.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a lot of impressive performances.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And just the whole movie was just expertly crafted. I mean, just art design alone. Maybe that's something that you kind of expect from a Del Toro movie. But it was just, it seemed like there was a tremendous amount of thought put into this world. And it was definitely given the time that it needed to be realized.
They did a really good job, again, in addition to making it feel period, making it feel like that 50s, 60s style. So many times... when people try that, it kind of looks a little like everything in it looks a little too old because obviously it was a long time ago. But like when he went to the car dealership, everything looked so pristine and new, like you're walking into that time period. Mm-hmm. It was great.
Mm-hmm.
So the period, obviously, set decorations and costumes was fantastic. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, you go first.
The grades I thought were interesting too, because when we go into the perfect world that Strickland goes into, either his home,
the lighting and color was so like 50s.
Everything's
so
very pristine. Yeah. Everything is like clean. But when you go into the lab and when you go into Eliza's home or whatever, everything's very green or dark or blue, very much like oceany.
Yeah, giving that rich idealistic setting in Strickland's home, contrasting with the kind of dark, gritty, less appealing lab and apartment.
Which is interesting because all the characters that are in that world, that live in those darker places, those are the humanizing characters mm-hmm. of the story, mm-hmm. whereas the least human of them is in this pristine world, yeah. which I feel like yeah. is kind of insightful, that like maybe there is a darker side of our humanity, but in still the very end, it's still empathetic.
And maybe the darker side isn't where we think
yeah.
the darker side mm-hmm. is.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's brilliant. I like that.
That's a great point. And another thing I'm liking is that one thing I'm trying to watch a lot more critically when I'm watching films is lighting and, mm-hmm. and how lighting is done, as I'm wanting to go further into that or see further into that field. And one thing I'm really loving is movement in the lights. Mm-hmm. I love that. One of the big things we talked about previously for Blade Runner was there's the scenes when Wallace is talking and there's this constant light that is shifting across the whole scene the whole time. Brilliant. And this film also did a really beautiful thing that I thought was so cool. The light coming up through the floorboards of the movie theater below mm-hmm. in her apartment was so interesting, and it gave these beautiful dynamic moments where, you know, you just, it was very subtle. You just sort of saw that sort of shift in light across someone's face or across mm-hmm. the scene. Very, very subtly. You know, it is coming up through the floorboards. Yeah. And then also conversely, all the light whenever there is water, there's usually, for the most part, when there was water in a scene, there was, you saw the reflected bounce off the water, that ripply stuff on the walls or mm-hmm. the ceiling, usually when you had water as well, yeah. which I think is also, it just looks cool.
Yeah, great at, you know, yeah, setting the space, setting the tone, setting the atmosphere, having yep. that kind of light, you know, ripples effect or reflection mm-hmm. on the mm-hmm. wall. That's great too.
Yep. And you can also see in that and through some other elements where there's some really, I think, well done elements of foreshadowing that I like when elements of foreshadowing are put into a film, but they're not really the attention is not called mm-hmm. to them. It lets the audience make the connection after when you see the result of it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, obviously you see very early on, you see, Elisa drawing, making a bath in her morning routine. So there's already this connection to water, and then she ends up masturbating there as well. Another further connection we see down when yeah, she eventually has yep. sex with the creature.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And well, also
setting up the tub is like an intimate space.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. her bringing the creature into the tub into her intimate space yes. is symbolic too. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And also another one is you see elements of the escape setup. You see the laundry scene. You see the camera scene. And well, in the camera, it hits a little on the nose in the camera because you see this switch flick in her head when she's like, oh, well, we push the camera up mm-hmm. so you can't mm-hmm. see it so we can smoke on our breaks.
Right.
But then you see, you know, pushing these big laundry hampers around, and they don't really mention the laundry hampers or to call any attention to it other than the fact that they're just pushing them around and mm-hmm. loading some mm-hmm. laundry carts.
Yeah. I also really liked, it's not so subtle in the foreshadowing, but the scene where the Russian spy dude has his comrades come over and they give him information on the extraction, and he can see one of them has a gun, so he slowly grabs a knife, so there's some mm-hmm. tension there. Also the scene I really liked because it was pretty subtle in its execution was when Giles mm-hmm. when he went he was so focused on being accepted and reintroduced to this professional world he was kicked out of, which they didn't explain why, but I think we kind of know maybe it was
because he was gay and got out
and he was trying really hard to get back in, and the guy he was trying to show his painting to basically said it's not a good time, when it will be a good time. It's just, it wasn't said, but you could tell it's just like, no, leave, get out of here, don't come back. And I thought that was done very well. It's scenes like that where they don't say what is being said underneath is just kind of more powerful.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I agree completely.
Yeah. Anyway, closing thoughts on the film. I recommend it. I think it's another.
It'll be interesting to see. Is it up for any Academy Awards?
It's up for a bunch. Like, it did really. Let me get the number, but it's up for a ton.
I think it's definitely worth watching. Like, if you, I think we caught it on the end of it being out of theaters.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, I think if you can, you know, go out and see it, or if you can at a rerun theater, go do it, because I think it's just pretty to look at and watch. But it definitely invigorates me to go see the rest of Del Toro's collection.
Yeah, yeah. How many do we got? How many nominations?
13.
Wow.
13
wow.
nominations, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Costume Design, Best Cinematography.
I wouldn't be surprised for Best Director, definitely.
I think it would definitely be up there.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Trying to remember who else is up for Best Director. Let's see.
Did you say cinematography too?
Yes. Yep.
Do you think it contends with Blade Runner?
No.
I
think it was very good.
I would
agree. I think Blade Runner 2049 is, I think, probably the best cinematography I've ever seen.
Wow.
I think I think it would, at this point, it would be my number one pick.
Hmm.
Right. I think it was unbelievably stunning.
Mr. Deakins, that is finest.
Yep, I think so. And I think we talked about it before, but you can really see, and then there's some videos, like some montages of Deakins's cinematography over the years, and you can really see where, how his style has grown and developed, and how so much this is a culmination of all these different elements, and you can see where, like, oh, that bit is a little bit like from No Country for Old Men?
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't right.
Yeah.
Okay,
it's turning into a Deakins episode now.
Yeah, I know, right? And hopefully he gets it, because he's an older guy now. He's doesn't have very many films.
We could come back later with an episode on Tricks of the Trade with some of his finest little hacks.
Well, yeah, and it will be interesting because as of next month's episode, we will be on the other side of the Oscars.
Yes.
Maybe we can look at that real quick and just do a real quick thing at the end. Let's look at just at Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, like, see, like, give our guesses and see what how they come out. Okay.
Yep. So here, let me pull it up. So here are, for the 2018 Academy Awards, here is the list of nominees for Best Picture. We have The Shape of the Water, Phantom Thread, The Post, Darkest Hour, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Mississippi, Call Me by Your Name, Dunkirk, Get Out, and Lady Bird. I think the two most interesting ones on that list are Shape of the Water and Get Out, a horror film and a, for lack of a better one, fantasy film nominee. That's a pretty rare thing from the Oscars.
What do you think, David? What's your guess?
I think it might be Lady Bird. I've heard incredible things about that. I want to try and see it.
No Dunkirk love.
No,
I know. I think compared to some of the other ones, I think there are ones, like, I love Dunkirk, but I think there are some other ones that would be better. I don't think The Post will win. That is, I think some people were making fun of that in many ways, that they were making fun of Bridge of Spies, in that it's an Oscar film. It's a film designed to win Oscars. It's a Spielberg film starring Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. The Post is Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. It is designed, and when it came out as well, because it only recently came out, I think it just made it under the bar for being released last year.
I'm surprised Get Out is on there.
I think it's probably either going to be Call Me by Your Name. No, sorry. I think it's either going to be Darkest Hour or Lady Bird. I think Call Me by Your Name is getting a lot of hype too, but I'm not sure. I mean, I haven't seen these movies. This is just from what I've heard and what I'm guessing.
Yeah, but it'd be very interesting if Get Out won. That'd be very, very interesting.
Would that be the first horror movie to win?
It might be. I don't know if there is another one. Maybe like a really old, like, Dracula or Frankenstein may have done. I'd have to look.
I think that Best Picture will be Last Jedi.
Oh, you heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. You heard it here first.
No, I'd probably go with the safe bet, Lady Bird, on that one, which I still really want to see.
Here's an interesting thing I'm just seeing as a headline for CNN Money. All the Best Picture nominees combined made less money than Star Wars.
Wow. That's funny.
That is interesting.
So are we all in agreement that we think Deakins is going to win for cinematography?
I think so.
Yes, but
I... You think he's cursed, David?
Well, no. It's because one thing, and...
What's he up against?
Let me pull it up.
I have it.
Well, we'll save you our discussion about cinematography. Yeah. We're running long anyway. But anyway, thank you for listening to this episode of the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. We'll be back next time with episode 19. See you then.